This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, what's behind the rift between Qatar and several Gulf Cooperation Council states? And why does it matter? Hello again. I'm Carol Castiel. Earlier in June, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Bahrain, and Egypt cut diplomatic ties with Qatar and closed the Emirates' land, airspace, and ports, precipitating the worst Gulf Arab crisis in years. Tensions between Qatar and its neighbors have been simmering for years over allegations that Qatar foments regional unrest through its support of the Muslim Brotherhood and Qatar's ties to Iran, the primary rival of Saudi Arabia's Sunni monarchy. Qatar shares its main natural gas field, its source of enormous wealth, with Iran, a reality that Doha says forces it to adopt a softer line toward Tehran. The United States has strategic alliances with all GCC member states. The isolation of Qatar, led by Saudi Arabia and the UAE, may be having the opposite of the intended effect. Turkey has stepped in to supply most of the food that used to come overland from Saudi Arabia. The U.S. State Department this week bluntly questioned Saudi Arabia and the UAE for their boycott of Doha because of the lag in releasing their specific grievances over Qatar. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson urged that negotiations should be done in a civilized way and should not be conducted under pressure or the blockade. The small, energy-rich nation of Qatar is also an important U.S. ally. It is home to the Al Udeid Air Base, from which the campaign against the so-called Islamic State and the war in Afghanistan is conducted. Washington recently consummated a $12 billion deal with Qatar, signed for F-15 fighter jets. Pitting one group of long-standing American allies against another, the confrontation over Qatar risks undermining the U.S.-led campaign against ISIS and undermines efforts to combat Iran's hegemonic designs in the region, say regional analysts. Well, with us to discuss the rift over Qatar and its ramifications are two distinguished analysts. Hussein Ibish, a frequent commentator at these VOA microphones, is a senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington, and that's a think tank here in Washington. He is also a frequent contributor to Foreign Policy Magazine and The Atlantic. And Andrew Bowen. He's a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and that's a think tank here in Washington, where he focuses on Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states. He is also an advisor to Greenmantle, that's a geopolitical and economic advisory firm. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
Thank you so much, Carol.
Thank you very much.
Well, let me begin with you, Hussein. You've been at these microphones before to talk about what's really at the root of this rift between Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Bahrain, Egypt, and Qatar.
Now, I think it's a sense on the part of the Saudis and the Emiratis, plus their allies, but really the Saudis and the Emiratis, that Qatar doesn't only maintain its own foreign policy or takes a different line towards Iran, but the sense that Qatar has used its soft power arsenal, its massive soft power capabilities, and its ideational and ideological pull and capabilities in the region to undermine the national interests of Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Egypt, and others in two ways. Number one, by promoting a group of radical political actors on both the far right and the Muslim Brothers and other Islamists, and on the far left-wing Arab nationalists, pan-Arab nationalists led by a Palestinian called Azmi Bashara and others. And the other thing is the idea that they play a double game with Iran, is that their dealings with Iran are not straightforward at all, and that they have one policy in public and one in private. So it's a sense that Qatar is undermining their interests and has been doing so for years and years, and promised to stop doing it in 2014, but failed to live up to those promises.
And I inadvertently failed to mention one of the soft power platforms, which is the Al Jazeera Arabic Network.
Well, there's a whole panoply.
And many others, perhaps.
Yeah, there's Al Jazeera, which many people, I think, confuse Al Jazeera English with Al Jazeera. The main Al Jazeera is in Arabic, and that's what everybody cares about. There's this international Al Jazeera in English, which is extremely different in tone and substance. And then the other thing is there's this whole panoply of other websites and news stations and whatnot that take a very different line, but all of it supporting anti-status quo, revolutionary, and either right or left-wing radical points of view.
Let me turn to you, Andrew Bowen, at the American Enterprise Institute, for your interpretation of what's at the root of this rift.
I think it's really at the core of it. It's a food fight. It's a feud between Abu Dhabi and Doha, who both, frankly, double deal, and both, frankly, have very contrasting views for the region. One, Abu Dhabi supports secular, largely liberal slash autocratic regimes in the region. They think that brings order from chaos. While the Qataris tend to think that whether it's President Sisi or Colonel Haftar and others, that at the end of the day, they don't really provide stability. And in the end, when people come out to Tahrir Square and the state collapses, like we saw with Mubarak back in 2011, that you really need to have a more pluralistic engagement with society. But I think that this really comes down to very different views of the region, that Abu Dhabi has had a lot of grievances, Doha as well. And Saudi's kind of an awkward interloper, has always been, and so has the United States. And I think on media, it's kind of like it's amazing to see that Saudi-funded Qatar Insider calling openly in English, Spanish, Arabic, and I think soon French, it looks like, calling for the overthrow of the Emir of Qatar. Which is kind of like, if we talk about non-interference in each other's neighbors' affairs, it's really awkward when certainly Al Jazeera has done things, Arabic has done things that I personally think are inappropriate. You look at other news channels in the region, but it's gotten to a really nasty food fight right now.
Well, turning back to you, Hussein Ebush, Andrew Bowen brought in the United States. So we're going to get to the U.S. position in a moment,
okay.
But let me just get back to this so-called food fight. It's a power struggle here,
yes.
It's as you both said. So that leads me to ask you, did it have to come to this? Didn't the UAE, the Saudis, perhaps have a different alternative rather than, you know, cut off diplomatic ties? Such a, you know, a drastic measure.
It is very drastic. And more than that, parts of the measures are just not only indefensible, they're also, they've already harmed the states that have done it. And I'm talking here particularly of cutting off supplies of food and medicine. Now, of course, they're not, you know, the Qataris have other ways of getting food and medicine, so they're not condemning them to starve or not have medical treatment.
The Turks have stepped in that regard.
Yes, and the Qataris have a lot of money, so they're always going to be able to get this, but it's a sense of using food and medicine as a weapon. Also, family reunification, where, again, on all three of these measures, on food and medicine and families, they've said they're going to change that because it's been so counterproductive, and threatening to jail people for sympathy for Qatar. So all of that is too much for sure. Did it have to come to this? No, it didn't. And on two fronts. Number one, clearly, the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Egyptians and others could have handled this in a much more deft and skillful way. And you can see as they struggle to come up with a list of grievances that A, they can agree on, which is difficult, and B, that would be acceptable to the outside world and the United States, that they really weren't prepared for this. So they could have done more. At the same time, I don't think they wanted to go there originally. This originally started out as a media fight, and I think that's where they wanted to keep it. But the Qataris counterattacked in a way that was outrageous to the Saudis and the Emiratis, which was the release of hacked emails from the Emirati ambassador in Washington showing communications with a think tank called the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, which is a Jewish-American, essentially, think tank that's pro-Israel. And so the Qatari and their friends were essentially saying, you deal with the Israelis, you deal with Jews, and this is bad. And that was the proximate cause for the cutting off of relations and all that. So there's a sense in which this spiraled out of control. And I think both sides of late have tried to stop a further escalation because the Qataris can't sustain another escalation. And the other side has already taken way more risks than they would like.
So. That's a very, very interesting observation. Back to you, Andrew Bowen, because at the end of the day, don't all of these countries, all GCC members, have much more in common with each other than that which divides them? I mean, that is the need to combat extremist Islamic groups like the Islamic State and Iran, notwithstanding this more cordial relationship between Qatar and Iran because of the gas field, shared gas field.
And what's kind of interesting was about a week before the cut-up happened, Adel Joubert addressed the
Qatari... And Adel Joubert being the...
The Saudi foreign minister was in Doha to address the Qatari ambassadorial roundtable where all the ambassadors came back to Doha. And not once in those meetings did Adel Joubert even say anything about these escalating tensions. So I think on the one hand, like, this could have been as common brothers with shared interests, shared identity as well, that there could have, I personally thought there could have been ways that this could have been worked out. And I agree with you, the media campaign heated up. What's been unfortunate is, I think, as the FBI investigation showed, it was either other Gulf state members or others who kind of hacked into Qatar's news agency that kind of further spiked this. And then a disgruntled employee of the Harbor Group basically leaked these emails and it conflagrated. And I think personally right now, with a lot of other pressures in the region and with Mohammed bin Salman now as crown prince with oil at 45, he has much bigger fish to fry than waving his finger at his neighbor when he's dealing with the fact that the economy in Saudi is not doing well. And that's something, that is where his future really, he wants to take the country, which is the economy.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Hussein Ibish, he's senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington, and Andrew Bowen, from whom you just heard, he's visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. And we're discussing the rift between Qatar and other Gulf Cooperation Council states. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Sina Sadeghi, and she's a loyal listener from Tehran, Iran. Thanks for writing, Sina. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send us an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, Hussein Ibish, to continue the conversation about this rift among the Gulf Cooperation Council states over Qatar. What about the United States in terms of its role? Let's be very clear. The United States is an ally to all of these states, but we need to underscore the difficult position it's in because of the Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar, from which these campaigns against the Islamic State and the war in Afghanistan are conducted. So they have a delicate role here.
Yes, and the United States actually has its key bases in three of the countries in question. In Qatar, as you mentioned, CENTCOM and other assets of essential to projecting power, not just in the Middle East and into Afghanistan, but into the Indian Ocean. So the United States definitely has a very strong interest in not having these countries fighting among themselves, that's for sure. But there are competing American interests here. And you can link all of it to Trump's visit in Riyadh. On the one hand, his overarching message was unity among allies, unity, unity, unity. On the other hand, he laid out three priorities. One was counterterrorism, confronting extremism, etc. Second, confronting Iran, rolling back Iran. And the third was Israeli-Palestinian peace. Now, the first two are agenda items in the list of grievances against Qatar. And the first one is undermined by the campaign, the unity theme. So on the more specific policy fronts, I think the United States does have a stake in the outcome in the sense that if the Saudis and the Emiratis and others are going to be able to push Qatar to distance themselves, stop their dalliances with extremists and radicals, and be more circumspect about Iran, that helps the United States. On the other hand, overarchingly, on the theme of unity, the big theme, this is very bad for the United States. That's why you've seen such a mixed reaction from the administration. Trump coming out very heavily in favor, especially of King Salman, but and generally against the Qataris, accusing it of funding terrorism at a very high level and accusing it of having an extremist ideology. Those are both direct quotes. Then Tillerson saying, on the one hand, we want the countries to ease the blockade. On the other hand, Qatar must change and change quickly. Those are also, and then this attack by the State Department on the bloc confronting Qatar, saying you haven't presented a list of grievances, and questioning their motives and saying, is this really about terrorism or is it about some undefined argument that you've been having? And so in a sense now both sides have felt the back of the American hand. It's still the case though that there's only one demand for change, and that's a demand on Qatar. So there's still, I think the United States has more or less sided against Qatar, but in a way that's increasingly getting frustrated with all parties and with the whole process.
So back to you, Andrew Bowen. Does the United States have leverage with Qatar since it has a huge air base that Qatar helps to underwrite? So the question again is, can the United States, can the Trump administration on the one hand mollify the Saudis and the UAE and still remain on good terms with Qatar?
I think that, and where Hussein and I may disagree, is I don't think the administration has sided against Qatar. I think that for the president, or at least for his national security team and the process so far, which is being led by Secretary Tillerson, our Secretary of State, and the message has been pretty clear, and that has been that we have a number of strategic allies, that Qatar and UAE and Saudi have differences, but those differences are not necessarily tied to U.S. interests. Those are tied to differences amongst themselves, and it is not our job to kind of referee a children's playground, but it is more to focus on addressing where it confronts our issues, and one of them's terrorism financing. I think there's a deep concern that Doha needs to take more steps. I think in the coming months, Dubai, Kuwait, and others also have to look at those as well. So that is one area, and I think the president made that pretty clear. I think the problem right now is Abu Dhabi's terrorist is not necessarily the United States' terrorist all the same time, and vice versa. So I think there are these differences there. And then on the second portion, I think, of the focus the president has made on Iran has been this idea that, like, all these states have very kind of complicated relations with Iran. Like, most of Iran's banking, commerce, back money dealing goes through the UAE. And I think there's a certain kind of sense of, like, how all these states kind of need to do better on it. But I think Qatar has been singled out. But at the moment, I think there is a united path. The question, though, is there are certainly some rhetorical differences, and I think this administration has struggled with trying to have a consistent process and message, which has given mixed messages to
No question.
Indeed. And so, Hussein Ibish, you know, again, notwithstanding many shortcomings on the part of Qatar, whether it's through their media outlets, support for Muslim Brotherhood, which Saudi Arabia and the UAE find anathema. Look, the Saudis and the UAE, particularly the Saudis, you know, are not necessarily angels. They are fighting terrorism ostensibly, but other analysts would say that they also fuel it, particularly Saudi Arabia, because of the Wahhabi doctrine, this fundamental ideology, which some could argue is the basis for some of the most virulent Islamist groups in the region, at least the ideological basis.
Common origins, certainly,
So again, what do you say to those types
of... I think the second criticism is a valid one. It's just, it doesn't go to the specific argument here, which is about Qatar's relationship with its neighbors and allies. They went through this once before, in 2014, where they thought they'd gotten Qatar's assurance to do better. And for about a year and a half, half a year or three quarters of a year, the Qataris really did change. In a lot of 2015, they behaved very differently. But towards the end of 2015, from the point of view of these countries, they started to renege and backtrack, and now they're, as open quote, as bad as ever, or if not worse. And so the sense is that on the Emirati and Saudi side is that they don't feel conflicted, number one. And number two, and they're talking about their own national interests. So, you know, everybody, I mean, Andrew's right. You know, everybody has their own different lists of terrorists. And for the United States, for example, the PKK in Turkey is terrorist and in Syria is not terrorist. So it all gets very complicated. But the bottom line is these countries will not go through 2014 again. They won't accept that Qatar just signs a vague piece of paper that's one sheet and five bullet points and then it lays low for a few months and then goes right back to behaving the way they did. They want something more. And I think in the end, the United States is going to push for two things. Number one, a quick resolution to this, because we need that. And number two, I think we are going to want to push Qatar because some of the demands being made are actually would be good for the United States and consistent with the president's priorities.
Well, back to you, Andrew Bowen, talking about a quick resolution. Why is it important on a geopolitical basis for the world? And some would argue it's because this little spat, or food fight as you called it earlier in the program, is diverting attention from a common enemy, you know, fighting the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, and trying to combat Iran's nefarious hegemonic activities, trying to build the equivalent of a land bridge through the Levant, through Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. Would you say that that's the case?
Yes. I personally think that as much as they saw the naming of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman as, they called it a soft coup, they were, they see increased Saudi aggression as a threat to Tehran, that they, that I think they're going to have to account now more for Saudi in their strategic calculus. On the other hand, they've gotten some relief, because when Doha and Riyadh are too busy fighting amongst themselves, Iran gains. And and I think we're moving in, honestly, to a fractured Gulf, where whether Qatar remains part of the GCC or not, and I think Qatar could actually leave the GCC or could be expelled and have a, quite an interesting new alignment in the region, where you have Qatar, Turkey, sometimes Kuwait, sometimes Oman, on the one hand, and then you have Saudi Arabia and the UAE, and then you have Russia intermediating and the U.S., and that's a much more complicated picture for us in Washington as we're trying to push back against Iran.
Well, again, it sounds like music to Tehran's ears, and maybe even Moscow, this spat here.
Definitely in the immediate term, they benefit. There's no question. I would draw the future map a little differently, but I agree there's a future map emerging. I don't know if it will emerge or not. We already have the three camps more or less in place, ideological camps, the sort of more conservative groups, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Jordan, and Egypt. Those are the key figures there. And then a sort of Islamist bloc of Qatar, Turkey, Muslim Brotherhood, Hamas, and then the pro-Iranian camp of Iran, Syria, Hezbollah, the Iraqi militias, etc. And that's sort of the breakdown we have now. But for sure, Iran benefits in the short run. Now, will they benefit in the long run? It depends on what this does to unity. Now, there are two points of view. For sure, this is disunity in the immediate moment. And the Saudis and the Qataris and the Emiratis knew this was going to happen. They're not stupid. In fact, their attitude is much better expressed through the foreign secretary of the Emirates, who said the other day, Anwar Gargash, he said that this could go on for years. And that's their attitude. You know, they're willing to drag this out forever to get their way. In the long run, they think they're going for unity worthy of the name. In other words, they think the unity that existed 4 weeks ago, 5 weeks ago, was a phony unity, a false unity. And they want everyone to come together more. And as I say, they don't mind if you have a separate foreign policy, a different relationship with Iran, like Kuwait or Oman. What they don't want is undermining their policies and the overall approach, which is what they think Qatar has done.
Well, the last word to you, Andrew Bowman, to talk about whether or not it's significant if the GCC is seen to disintegrate. What impact does that have on combating, you know, Iran and on U.S. interests in the region? And do you see an end to this compromise coming out of this current stalemate or rift?
I'm more optimistic that there's going to be an uneasy compromise, which, as we say, noted, I think it may end up going back to how it was before, but more avenues for Ankara and Moscow and others to challenge, frankly, Saudi leadership in the Gulf. And I think what's going to make it more difficult for Washington is, instead of having, I think President Trump saw Saudi leadership as underpinning his Middle East strategy. Now we're entering an environment where it's not just Saudi we have to take account of. We have to take account of Ankara as well. And there will be states in the region who may want to go towards Ankara instead of Saudi. So I think it's going to make it more difficult right now for Washington to do both pushing back on ISIS and Iran.
Well, it depends on the outcome, though. It really depends on the outcome. We have, let's see how far Qatar does bend, because there is a scenario in which Saudi Arabia emerges from this bloodied but strengthened.
Well, on that note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Hussein Ibish, senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington, and Andrew Bowman, visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Gentlemen, thanks so much for coming in, sharing your insights.
Thanks, Carol. Appreciate it.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Thomas Blondet. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.